I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. In July, Cuba raised its national flag over its embassy in Washington, D.C. This Friday, Secretary of State John Kerry will be in Havana to raise the American flag over the U.S. embassy in Cuba. That ceremony is another milestone in the thawing relations between these two countries, orchestrated most recently by President Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro. We asked Michael Weisenstein, AP Bureau Chief in Havana, to join us on Radio Times. And Michael, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. How will this event be marked on Friday?
John Kerry will fly down early from Washington. There will be a ceremony at the new U.S. Embassy on the Malecón, the Havana waterfront. He'll raise the flag, and then we'll have a meeting with the Cuban foreign minister. Afterwards, we'll talk to the press, and then we'll another flag at the U.S. Chief of Missions House, a sort of fancy residential area of Havana. And at that event, we'll sort of, instead of the Cuban government officials and diplomats that will be at the morning event, what they call Cuban society, which includes some of the dissidents.
Well, interestingly, and I'm looking at the Associated Press from this morning, you write, or some of your reporters here write, that dissidents are not being invited to this ceremony on Friday. How come?
The dissidents have always been a big point of tension between the U.S. and Cuba, and the relationship, the sort of triangular relationship between Cuba, the U.S., and the dissidents has really shifted since December 17th when the two governments decided to open diplomatic relations or reopen diplomatic relations. The Cubans have always made clear that they see the dissidents as illegitimate and traitors and mercenaries in the pay of the U.S. and Cuban Americans in Miami. And this extends to the point where Cuban officials will not attend events where there are dissidents. So that obviously presented a problem for the U.S. as it was organizing this, you know, very symbolic and historically laden event on Friday. They didn't want to be seen as abandoning the dissidents who have been a focus of U.S. policy on Cuba for so many decades, but neither did they want a boycott by Cuban officials. So they decided to sort of split the baby by having only government officials at the morning ceremony and the dissidents attend the afternoon twin flag raising at the residence.
Does that satisfy the dissidents, those that will be invited, or will it feel sort of like the JV event?
I think some of them are disappointed. There's a range of opinions among the dissidents, as there is among all Cubans. And since the very beginning of the detente with Cuba, some of the dissidents have supported it. Others have been strongly against it. And the opinion on how the U.S. is handling the Friday events, I think, is shaking out along the same lines.
Going back to the article today, and I'm quoting here, according to an Associated Press count that matches tallies by leading dissidents, more than 20 U.S. lawmakers have visited Cuba since February without meeting the opposition groups that were once obligatory for congressional delegations. And it sounds like since this thaw, there has been less contact between U.S. officials and dissidents in Cuba.
I think there's been less formal contact. I think the embassy, now embassy, as of July 20th, still maintains contacts with the dissidents. I don't think they've cut them off entirely. But absolutely, the game has completely changed. I mean, now when business people and members of Congress and on Friday administration officials come down, they're trying to move along the formal opening with Cuba, which includes business ties. And since the Cubans have made clear that they're not going to do that if the visitors meet with dissidents, it's the dissidents who are losing out here.
I'm curious about even the U.S. embassy in Havana. Is it reopening the old embassy there? Is this a new building? What can you tell us about
it? It's the same building, and it's been, for many years, the biggest diplomatic presence in Cuba. I mean, there are thousands of Cubans a year lining up outside what was, until the 20th, the U.S. interest section. What it is, and that interest section before 1961 was the embassy. What it is just changing the status of this big building on the Malecón, on the waterfront, changing that status back into an embassy with a flag flying outside.
Has there been any visible difference as the U.S. and Cuba thaw the tense relationships of the past?
In Cuba, there's been a boom in tourism, a small boom of Americans, because you're starting from smaller numbers of American visitors, and a big boom in Europeans and to a lesser extent Latin Americans, who want to come, as everybody says, before the Americans do. And there has been a few sort of first feelers of American business coming into Cuba, not a huge amount. And then there has been also an upswing in Cubans trying to go to the United States for a sort of complicated reason. They think that if there are normal relations between the U.S. and Cuba, these special immigration privileges that Cubans have received since the start of the Cold War, or a little after, will disappear, and Cubans will no longer be able to show up in the States and automatically get legal residence. So people are leaving for the U.S. at an even faster pace than before.
I thought it was interesting that Airbnb is the first American business that's really taking a look at Cuba as a place to do business.
Yeah, they were very fast. I think they are just nimbler and more aggressive at these things because of the nature of who they are, a sort of internet-based company. And then also, they had the good fortune of plugging into a legally and culturally existing framework here, which is Cubans renting out rooms in their homes. And it's sort of a perfect fit for Airbnb. It was one of the first economic reforms that was put in place by the Castros. And it's developed into a important part of the tourist economy and a real source of income, important essential source of income for many, many Cubans.
You also wrote about the fact that Cuba is now expanding wireless internet access. How extensive is that?
That's an important change. It's not hugely extensive. It's 35 government internet cafes, government internet centers around the country. But it's a real change for Cubans. I mean, they can now show up with their own devices and get for half the price a faster connection than they were getting before. So that's a significant development that certainly the U.S. likes to believe, and I think it's certainly credible that it's due to, or at least came about faster due to the warming with the U.S. And the Obama administration said right from the very beginning when it announced this opening with Cuba that Cuba had promised to expand internet access, and they sort of cite that promise when they look at the expansion in internet that's happened here over the summer.
What about these 90 miles between Cuba and the United States? I guess it's called the Florida Straits. It's been an area of both conflict and area of escape. Is that a different waterway now?
What we've started to see is, in addition, with more people heading north on rafts, which has been a sort of decreasing and increasing flow for decades and is now on the upswing. We've seen legal luxury U.S. yachts starting to come down with Florida. They've been coming down illegally for a long time, but now as a sort of authorized legal way of wealthy Americans coming to Cuba, it's begun in earnest this summer. We had the first luxury yacht show up last week, and the charter company that received a license from the Obama administration says they expect to have what they call almost a whole fleet down here going back and forth to Florida by the winter.
And what are some of the issues, and I'll be talking more with our second guest about this, but what are still some of the points of conflict between the U.S. and Cuba?
Guantanamo and the embargo are the two big ones, and Cuba has said since the very beginning that there can't be a normal relationship before the U.S. lifts the embargo and returns Guantanamo. But I think both sides realize that both things are probably at the very least years off. The immediate points that I think they'll be negotiating now that they move into the normalization process after reopening embassies will be the issue of claims by U.S. citizens and companies who had their property confiscated during the revolution. It's going to be very hard to have normal trade ties, which both sides want to lesser or greater extent, if there's the threat of lawsuits in the U.S. by these claimants against any American company doing business in Cuba.
And it's interesting. I mean, I think on the mainland here, we don't think of Cuba as having sort of be a divided island, in that you've got Cuba on one side and you've got U.S. facility at Guantanamo Bay on the other side. Is there a true demarcation there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's a demilitarized zone that is, you know, American territory on one side and on the other. And there's been, you know, cooperation and not a lot of tension in recent years, but absolutely. I mean, there's a line, there's a wall.
And as you talk to the Cuban people, what kinds of expectations do they have as they look at this different relationship between their country and the United States?
I think it very much depends which Cuban you ask. I mean, there has been a sort of rising divisions inside this sort of theoretically egalitarian society for many years, even more so since the government launched reforms about 5 years ago. And that just keeps accelerating. I mean, with all the tourist money that's now coming in, those Cubans who have, often with help from relatives in Florida, plugged into that economy, had the capital to do it, are doing very well. And they're happy and optimistic. Those who are outside the economy still don't see a future for them in Cuba. I would say the average Cuban still sees, sadly, that their future, particularly young and educated Cubans, they see their future outside the country.
And outside the country, meaning these would be the people that would be looking to leave Cuba, looking for a better life?
These are among the many thousands of people that are looking to leave Cuba as quickly as possible.
And come to the United States or just come to another country?
A lot go to Spain, a lot go to Ecuador, but the real end goal for many is the U.S.
So what's the weather forecast for Friday and when all this happens at the U.S. Embassy?
Hot and possibly rainy, like any August day in Cuba.
Well, Michael Weisenstein, thank you so much for joining us once again on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Michael Weisenstein, AP Bureau Chief in Havana, telling us about what's happening this Friday. Secretary of State John Kerry in Havana to raise the American flag over the U.S. Embassy. We're going to take a very short break. We've got a second guest waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about the thaw between Cuba and the United States. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. President Obama said he wanted to write a new chapter in the relationship between the United States and Cuba, and he has made good on his promise. The U.S. officially reopens its embassy in Havana this Friday, restoring diplomatic relations after more than half a century. Our guest, Peter Kornbluh, writes about the secret negotiations that led to this thaw, including the involvement of Pope Francis in the latest edition of Mother Jones magazine. It's part of a new updated edition of his book called Back Channel to Cuba. And Peter Kornbluh directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive and joins us once again on Radio Times. And Peter, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be on your show again.
And what's the significance of this flag raising in Havana on Friday? Secretary of State John Kerry will be there.
Secretary of State John Kerry will become the highest-ranking U.S. official to set foot on the island of Cuba since the Fidel Castro-led Cuban Revolution in 1959. His mere presence there is an extraordinary indication of how far we've come in putting the past behind us, a past of perpetual hostility, invasion, CIA assassination plots, all sorts of regional pressures led by the United States, and moving forward to a new future, as Obama has said we we must do. The raising of the flag is going to be extraordinarily symbolic. The U.S. embassy was closed by President Eisenhower just before the Bay of Pigs invasion in early 1961. Jimmy Carter actually reopened the building in 1977 as an interest section, but right. Now with this flag going up, it is going to have the restoration of full embassy status, and that has significant symbolic and real meaning for the future of U.S.-Cuban relations.
And I want to talk about what's ahead and also how we got here, but I'm also curious about your response, and this is what I was talking about with Michael Weisenstein from the Associated Press, just quoting from the AP today, the Obama administration doesn't plan to invite Cuban dissidents to Secretary of State John Kerry's historic flag raising at the U.S. Embassy in Havana on Friday, vividly illustrating how U.S. policy is shifting focus from the island's opposition to its single-party government. Should dissidents be invited, do you think?
Well, I think that this diplomatic event is meant to be a symbol of better relations, of cordial relations, of respectful relations. And having the dissident community there runs a significant risk of major disruption and major insult to the Cuban government at the very moment in which the two sides are trying to establish a steady foundation to move forward. It is not to say that the United States doesn't support many things that the dissidents want in Cuba. It is to say that the United States government, the Obama administration, believes that these better relations with the Castro regime will, and these changes that we are now supporting in Cuba and will be part of, that positive engagement will actually lead to more political space eventually for the dissident movement. Less threat from the United States, more latitude for forces, social and civil forces and political forces in Cuba. This is a key issue in kind of the future of U.S.-Cuban relations, whether normal relations are just a Trojan horse to continue the U.S. tradition of regime change efforts in Cuba. And that had been at the heart of the major negotiations, the minor details of who's going to be invited to this event on Friday. It's a very important issue. And I just think Obama's position is, look, we're not going to stick it to the Cubans. This is not about insulting them now. This is about creating a stable relationship, a cordial relationship, in which kind of the historical threat of U.S. intervention in Cuba goes away, and the Cuban society can deal with itself without that shadow hanging over it.
I mean, is that wishful thinking, or do you think, as you understand the Cuban government, that they will have a more benevolent and open attitude and approach to dissidents in their own country?
I mean, Marty, you and your listeners know what happened in our own country after the attack of 9/11, and the threat of terrorism became significant here. There were a lot of national security changes here, many of which many people in the United States feel were horrible and repressive and not in keeping with our values. And Cuba has been kind of a national security state, if you will, since the revolution, with the threat of U.S. intervention, which has been real. I mean, we did lead an attack on Cuba at the Bay of Pigs in 1961. The first person on the beach at the Bay of Pigs was a CIA officer planting a light beacon so that the rest of the exile invasion force would know where to go from the ocean. And so this has been a real issue and a real threat. And if that changes, and hopefully the kind of this national security nature of the Cuban state can also change, the reformers will gain more power internally. And, of course, Cuba is in a major transition, which I think you and the AP Bureau Chief Michael talked about, from kind of strict kind of communist economic society to a much more market-oriented type of economy. And that is going to create more space in the lives of Cuban citizens, which may translate into political organizing as well somewhere down the line. You have to have a somewhat more long-term perspective on this. Certainly, our policy of the past didn't achieve our goals and was counterproductive in every level, and this is much more in keeping with the idea of constructive engagement and the idea with the way the United States should relate to other countries that truly aren't a national security threat to us.
And I do want to talk about some of the back channel negotiations that got us to this point. Your book is actually about how the U.S. and Cuba have had back channel negotiations since the time of Kennedy. But do you think, and would you suggest, and do you think President Obama will visit Cuba before he leaves office?
You know, Secretary of State Kerry's visit is a major symbolic step forward. He's the highest-ranking official to go there. Only a few weeks after he goes and leaves, Pope Francis, who we're going to talk about, who played a significant role in the back-channel diplomacy, is going to visit Cuba, and there'll be a lot of attention to that visit. And thereafter, you're going to see the steady parade of corporate CEOs and that's already going on. Governors, the governor of Arkansas is going to go. The governor of New York already went. And I actually think that we will see President Obama go to Cuba sometime, perhaps next spring, and become the first president of the United States to set foot on the island of Cuba since the revolution. That will be kind of his Nixon in China moment, Obama's Nixon in China moment. And I think it will also, of course, bring – Obama will bring all sorts of interests that he'll push, including the kind of more opening for civil society in Cuba. And that'll be very dynamic. It's something really to – in some ways to look forward to.
Well, I do want to talk about some of the secret backdoor negotiations between the Obama administration, the administration of Raul Castro in Cuba. When did that start? And the president, you know, early on said, look, I want this new chapter in this relationship. When did they begin to, I guess, get down to business to try to effect some change?
Well, you know, I was on your show when the book that I did with William Leo Grand of American University came out last fall. That was in October that it was published, and I think we talked then. And then just a few weeks after that, on December 17th, President Obama and President Castro kind of simultaneously announced that they had been involved in secret back-channel diplomacy for the last 2 years. And Bill Leo Grand and I said, geez, we have to write a whole new epilogue to the book. And we did. We went out. We investigated what happened secretly over the last 2 years. We talked confidentially with the top negotiators, with the White House officials, with State Department officials, and with the private sector intermediaries who were involved in all sorts of extraordinary efforts to bring the United States and Cuba together starting in 2013. And it's a marvelous story. It's told in the current issue of Mother Jones, as you mentioned, but it'll also be told at much greater length in the paperback edition of the book that comes out. And, President Obama, when he was reelected, he really saw the opportunity politically to move on this. He didn't have to worry about whether it would cost him the next campaign. He didn't have to worry about raising money in Florida for another campaign. And right after his reelection at the end of 2012, he called his key staff in and said, I want to design a play, using a football metaphor, to run on Cuba. Let's see what we can do. And through back channels, they sent a message to the Cubans, we'd like to talk. The first meeting was set up with the secret support of the Canadian government in Ottawa in June of 2013. And after that, there were eight more secret meetings in various places, including Rome under the auspices of Pope Francis. And through these meetings, a lot was worked out. A prisoner exchange, an agreement to normalize diplomatic relations, an agreement to open up the embargo and let the internet companies in to help Cuba modernize its electronic internet grid, which is really from the dark ages. I can tell you, having just been in Cuba last week, and really move forward in the relationship. And as Obama put it, you know, put the past behind us and look to the future. As he stated on July 1st, this is what change looks like, and it's true. President Obama and Raul Castro have actually managed to bury the hatchet on one of the most acrimonious 50 years in U.S. foreign relations with another country, and this is a This is a historic moment right now.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Peter Kornbluh. He directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. And yes, wrote a book called Back Channel, co-wrote a book called Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. Was a guest on Radio Times talking about that book. But as he said, shortly after that conversation, it became clear. And as President Obama and President Raul Castro announced a much more normalized relationship. And our guest has done some more research, dug up some more material, and the epilogue of this new updated edition of the book is in the current edition, the September-October edition of Mother Jones Magazine. To join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. What do you think of these more normalized relations? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, we are all about Pope Francis here in Philadelphia because he'll be coming to the city in a little more than a month. And frankly, it's all Pope Francis all the time. He plays such an interesting role in these negotiations between Cuba and the United States. And I guess it begins with the idea that he had a pretty good relationship with Cuba and also with the Cuban president.
Pope Francis had been to Cuba before. He went with the previous pope on a trip in 1998, or I guess two popes ago, actually. And he wrote a little book about that trip. He's the first, you know, Latin American pope. He's from Argentina, so right. He speaks Spanish, obviously, and has a real rapport with the Cubans. But he also obviously could provide kind of a political blessing, if you will, and help Obama with right-wing opposition to this major political move that Obama intended to make on Cuba policy. And so the new edition of the book tells this extraordinary story,
yeah, really,
really of a number of groups who decided that having the Pope involved would be a good idea. And independent of each other, they all went out, found a different cardinal, one cardinal in Boston, one cardinal in Washington, the cardinal of Havana, Cardinal Ortega, to all kind of push the Pope on helping Obama to arrange a prisoner swap to get Alan Gross, this USAID contractor who'd been in prison in Cuba for almost 5 years, out in return for the release of these three Cuban spies who had been in prison here for attempting to spy on exile groups in the United States. They'd been in prison for almost 16 years. And to arrange that prisoner swap and open the door for actually a change of U.S.-Cuban relations. And Obama's people saw the wisdom in this, too, and they actually reached out through their own back channel to the Pope, and a meeting between Obama and the Pope was arranged. The Pope was fully briefed on the issues by all these other players, and they talked about what the Pope could do. Mm-hmm. And he actually then took steps to communicate with both Raul Castro and President Obama, and kind of the way that one conducts secret diplomacies and gets messages to the President of the United States in this context is really quite fascinating. We tell the story in the book. It's not like you just send an email to the White House, and it's very complicated.
Well, it is, but to me, I just my eyes were wide open here, because what happens is the Pope gives to the Cuban Cardinal Ortega some letters that he wants directly given to President Obama, and Ortega is secreted into the White House so he can make this personal delivery to the president in the White House from the Cuban Cardinal Ortega.
Well, that's right. But, of course, Ortega has to figure out how to get into the White House. Right. And that necessitates him sending one of his top aides to Washington and as an advance man to figure it out. The White House actually preferred not to take the risk of a leak of him coming to Washington. And so they asked the Cardinal of Washington, Cardinal McCarrick, to go to Cuba, actually carrying a letter from President Obama to Ortega saying, will you accept Cardinal McCarrick as an interlocutor, as an intermediary, and give him the letter to bring back? That would be safer. And Cardinal Ortega's diplomatic instructions from Pope Francis are to deliver the letter himself. And so he says, no, I can't. I have to come myself. And then arrangements are secretly made for him for him to come to Washington under the guise of giving a talk at Georgetown University and quietly go to the Rose Garden to hand this communication to President Obama. So it is very back channel, very furtive, very secretive. But, you know, you have to hand it to all these individuals and the President of the United States. The secret was kept. They succeeded. And here we are today, 8 months after all this was revealed, awaiting John Kerry's presence in Havana to raise the flag, the stars and stripes, over the new embassy there. And so they succeeded, and it's a story that really is going to go down in the annals of U.S. diplomacy and U.S. foreign policy as a memorable time.
And how did they get Cardinal Ortega into the White House?
Well, they were obviously knew he was coming, were waiting for him. They kept his name off the visitor logs so nobody would see that he was coming or had been there. I'm sure he's not the first person to have secretly met with the President of the United States, and he won't be the last. It was an interesting moment. Obama, it was a year ago, I think, this week, on August 18th last year, that this happened. And Obama had been in Martha's Vineyard, where he's just left for today, where he vacations every year. And he actually came back from his vacation a couple of days early for other reasons, and so he was there for this meeting, obviously, and the communication went forward. And I should add, that after this letter was delivered, the Pope invited both the Cuban negotiators and the secret U.S. negotiators, who were two of Obama's top aides, Ricardo Zuniga of the National Security Council and Benjamin Rhodes, Deputy National Security Advisor, to Rome to meet with the Cuban negotiating team last October and iron out the final details of actually this whole normalization process. And the Pope oversaw those meetings. Cardinal Ortega flew in from Havana and contributed. That was the coup de grace. That was the final significant meeting to bring us to today.
Well, we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about the backdoor negotiations helping to lead to the thaw between the United States and Cuba. Peter Kornbluh, our guest, call us at 1-888-477-9499 and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been talking about the secret backdoor negotiations between President Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro going back a couple of years involving Canada, Cardinals, Pope Francis. And this is all part of what will be the paperback edition of our guest book called Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. And some of this information in the latest edition of Mother Jones magazine. We've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We also have some emails at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we are talking about this new and very different relationship between Cuba and the United States. Let me get Joe from Sewell, New Jersey to join us. And Joe, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
A question for your guest. My grandparents and my father are Cuban. I'm Cuban. My father fled Cuba in 1960. My grandparents stayed behind. They didn't want to leave their home, but eventually they were allowed to leave when they were 65 years of age and no longer of any use to the state. Question, what can I or my father, who has passed away, what could we do to reclaim my family's assets? Their home was there. They were not allowed to transfer any funds out of Cuba when the state allowed them to leave. So we need to know, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of Cubans who want to know what can be done to reclaim any family assets that were stolen by the government.
Joe, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Peter, this actually came up when I was talking with Michael Weisenstein about some of the issues that have not been resolved yet. And what Joe described is one of those issues.
Yeah, compensation for expropriated properties, both residents and businesses and corporate assets of U.S. companies has been an outstanding issue, of course, since the time of the revolution, when Fidel Castro started seizing U.S. interests and then took over the houses of people who left. And it's a very sensitive issue. It's a very complicated issue. And the United States has, in previous secret talks with the Cubans, going all the way back to the Kennedy times, but particularly during the era of Gerald Ford and Henry Kissinger's secret diplomacy with Castro, you know, the United States and Cuba have tried to address this issue, and position papers have been written. Cuba has a position that they owed a lot of money from the costs of the trade embargo against Cuba, which they consider illegitimate and illegal. And they always counter with that demand when the issue of compensation for these properties come up. I do think that what's going to happen now is in just a very patient, diplomatic way, eventually U.S. officials and Cuban officials kind of meeting at the U.S. Embassy in Havana or the Cuban Embassy in Washington will kind of under a much more kind of normal umbrella of relations start to talk about this and see if there's some type of way to compensate some of these claims. It's not going to happen quickly. It's never been an issue that's been at the top of the list of priorities. It's kind of down at the bottom, not because it's not important, but because it's so difficult, along with Guantanamo, to resolve. And I do think that Cuban Americans, like your caller, are going to have to be patient, but that at some point a mechanism will come into play in which they can present their claims again.
And doesn't Cuba want Guantanamo back?
Cuba wants Guantanamo back, but they've never made it a top demand for normal relations. Raul Castro has been quoted, and I have to say misquoted in the American press, as demanding this. But what he's really said is, look, we can't actually have normal relations in a sense when a whole part of our island is occupied against our will. The base was not legitimately rented by the United States, and we haven't cashed any of those rental checks, you know, since 1959, the leasing checks, and we want Guantanamo to is Guantanamo's sovereign Cuban property, and we would like it back. But they understand that this is a difficult issue, but and it's not one. It's obviously not a deal breaker because we are where we are today. But that issue will be addressed too, and I think actually all of us are going to live to see the day in the next 5 or 10 years in which Guantanamo is returned to Cuba or transformed into some type of international facility on the island.
Where does Fidel Castro stand on this thawed relationship?
Well, you know, tomorrow is Fidel Castro's 89th birthday.
Oh, really?
He's quite old now and frail. It's interesting. He maintained his silence after the accord was announced on December 17th last year. And he maintained his silence for so long that the anti-Castro Cubans in Miami started to spread rumors that he had died because they couldn't conceive of him not kind of making a statement. Eventually, he made a kind of an indirect statement in a letter to a student federation saying that he respected the need for dialogue, but he didn't trust the Americans. But he still believed that under the auspices of international law, we should have civil relations. And his statement was somewhat tepid in a way. But the truth is, if you read our book, Back Channel to Cuba, you will see that Fidel Castro went out of his way to reach out to every new president with a kind of an olive branch of better relations. He did this with Kennedy. He did this with Johnson. He did this unbelievably with Richard Nixon, using the Swiss as an intermediary, the Swiss government, only 11 days after Nixon's inauguration. He did it with Reagan. He did it with all the presidents. And his intent was, of course, to say Cuba is open to normal relations with the United States. We won't be told what to do. We won't yield our political sovereignty to you. We won't accept orders from the Goliath of the North. But we are open to discussing better relations and having better relations. And so Castro historically, in many ways, paved the road for the agreement that is being implemented today.
I'm looking at some of the photographs in your book, Fidel Castro and James Donovan on a fishing trip at the Bay of Pigs, April 8th, 1963. In 62, Donovan successfully negotiated with Castro for the release of the Bay of Pigs prisoners. On another page, there's Fidel Castro with Frank Mankiewicz delivering a message from Secretary of State Henry Kissinger.
Yes, Frank Mankiewicz, all of your listeners should know, was once president of National Public Radio.
Right, just to add to the drama there. Let me get some callers, more callers. And we've got John from, looks like, Moorestown, New Jersey. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you for the show. It's great listening. It takes a lot of courage for the president to pull a Nixonian move. Why do you think he was able or willing to do that at this time?
You know, it's an excellent question, and I think there are two reasons. One is that I think Barack Obama came into office. He actually ran on a campaign platform of reaching out through diplomacy with states in which we had hostile relations. So you'll recall an early debate between him and Hillary Clinton in 2007 and then again in 2008 in which he said, you know, I believe in diplomacy and I would sit down with the president of Cuba, I would sit down with the president of Iran, and I would try and iron these things out diplomatically. And Hillary Clinton's response was, well, I wouldn't do that, you know, unless the conditions were, you know, completely appropriate. And Obama really believed in this, and in that way he was very much a Jimmy Carter disciple. Carter also believed in the philosophy of diplomacy over pressure and engagement over aggression. So Obama came in saying, I want to write a new chapter of relations with Cuba, but politically it's not that easy. And over the course of 4 years, a number of things impeded his ability to do this. One was the arrest of Alan Gross, a USAID contractor who was on a George Bush program, democracy promotion program in Cuba, surreptitiously setting up satellite communications channels for independent communities to have independent communications with the United States. It was part of USAID's contingency planning for you know, the outbreak of upheaval and democracy in Cuba down the road. With Gross arrested, then the issue became how to get him out, because politically, if he didn't, if he wasn't released, it would be impossible to normalize relations with Cuba. And then the issue was that Cuba had a demand in return. They want their spies back. These were spies that had been arrested 15, 16 years ago, most of them a spy ring called the WASPs network. And they had come here, about 15 of them, over the course of the mid-1990s, mostly to focus on the exile groups, which were either funding or actually instigating violent activities towards and threatening activities towards Cuba. So there was this whole issue of prisoner exchange that was politically difficult, that held up the process. But a number of things happened. One was that opinion polls changed in Florida and across the country. Obama, to his credit, opened the door for Cuban-American travel. Whenever they wanted, Cuban-Americans from Florida could start traveling to the island. And that helped change public opinion in Florida such that Florida was no longer a political swing state on the Cuba issue. Then there was the fact that the rest of the Latin American region was in rebellion against U.S. policy, and the United States was finding itself very isolated and very pressured by the other Latin American states to change the policy on Cuba. And then there was the issue of the changes in Cuba. Raul Castro was clearly on the path towards economic reforms. He was going to be leaving power in 2018. Fidel Castro is out of the picture now. And it was an appropriate time to start to build bridges of engagement that then could perhaps lead to some type of U.S. support for the changes going on there. So that's why he took all these steps now. He still needed the Pope's blessing and divine intervention from Rome and a bunch of back-channel intermediaries. But he went ahead and did it. And when you talk to his top aides, as we did for this new edition of the book, you know, they say, look, the president really wanted to do this, and that's why it happened.
Well, we got let me read a couple of emails. One from MP: what is the status of fugitive repatriation as it relates to normalization? Question from John: how can we normalize relations when they're holding fugitives? An email from Richard: although I'm of the opinion that normalizing relations is probably for the better, I'm certain that there is a different opinion as to the limited extent of any civil society or political openings in the Castro Castro dictatorship. Hard to imagine the Castro brothers allowing an economic flowering of that island, much less political openness. So a lot of suspicion, a lot of important questions, too, that we probably don't know the answers to. But what are your thoughts about some of those more skeptical views of this new relationship?
Well, I was just in Cuba last week, and I can say that certainly the whole issue of economic opening is moving forward. It's not moving forward as fast as many Cubans would like, but it is moving forward steadily, and it's not going to be reversed. So on the economic side, Cuba is going to open up and become a much more modern kind of capitalist market-oriented state, and that is going to have an impact on the daily lives of a lot of Cubans, although the Cubans that are still kind of in the state sector, it's as Michael Wasserstein pointed out, it's still a very difficult situation. But that is why they are moving in this direction. They want to create a tax base. They want to be able to have services for their people. Sustainable socialism is what Raul Castro has said he wants, but to sustain it, he needs a much more market-oriented economy. Whether the political opening follows, you know, that's going to be up to the Cuban people themselves. At least the United States will have more bridges, cultural, social, and economic, in which to push prod support, et cetera. None of these bridges we really had before this new opening. On the issue of fugitives, we are going to be negotiating that and talking to the Cubans about that issue. I should point out that there are quite a few Cuban exiles who have committed violent crimes against Cuba who live in the United States. One notable one, the godfather of Cuban exile terrorism, Luis Posada Carriles, who lives in Miami, Florida. He, according to CIA and FBI documents that my office obtained through the Freedom of Information Act and elsewhere, was responsible for blowing up a Cuban airliner and killing 73 civilians, men, women, and children on board in October of 1976. He told the New York Times he was responsible for a series of hotel and discotheque bombings in 1997 and 1998. So the Cubans would like him to be repatriated to Cuba to stand trial there, and there are other violent exiles in the United States as well. I should say that our sources told us that these issues did come up during these secret talks in the summer of 2014. But, of course, it was a dead end. The United States was not going to return Luis Posada Carriles to Cuba, and the Cubans weren't just going to up and give back the former Black Panthers and others who the United States now wants. But that will also be negotiated in this new framework of normal diplomatic relations.
We have a lot of people that want to join us. We have no time to actually take any more calls. But it should be said that the embargo is still in place. It is, I guess, what, against the law to travel, or you have to travel under pretty strict restrictions?
No. President Obama kind of loosened those restrictions. He kind of opened up 12 exemptions, including what he called educational travel, in which you basically, on your own volition, can say, I'm going down there to study, you know, the intersection between the sea and the sand. And just to give you an example, in other words, you can't openly go to vacation in Cuba, but you can go for educational purposes, for people purposes, for journalistic purposes, et cetera. And the number of U.S. citizens who have gone to Cuba since December 17th, when he announced this, has more than doubled and is, I think, on course to triple by the end of this year. But yes, there's still an overall travel ban that Congress has to lift. And I think the more people who travel to Cuba, the more pressure there will be on Congress to lift that ban and to lift the trade embargo overall, which now makes no sense.
Well, on that note, Peter Kornbluh, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're more than welcome. It's a great historic moment to be talking about U.S.-Cuban relations.
Indeed it is. And he directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. And a book he has co-authored, Back Channel to Cuba, will be updated and released in paperback this October. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.